Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, here's a stat for you. In the last 10 years, more than 300,000 scientific articles have been published and 700 startup companies have invested tens of billions of dollars into anti-aging research. I'm joined on the line now by Nobel Prize winner Venki Ramakrishnan. He's written a new book, Why We Die, The New Science of Aging and the Quest for Immortality. Good afternoon, Venki.
Good afternoon.
Fascinating book. Just thank you for writing it. Because you've worked in the area of molecular biology for how many years now?
Since 1978 or so.
Right. And you decided to write this because you don't have any skin in the game. Well, apart from all of us, we're all going to die. But other than that, you don't have skin in the game. So you're a sort of an independent observer of what's going on in this area.
Yes, you can think of me as an anthropologist of the aging research community.
Right, okay. And why now, Venki? Why write it now?
Well, I think we've always wondered, ever since we were aware of our mortality, and we may be the only species that knows that, we've always wondered why we have to age and why we have to die. But it's only in the last 50 years or so that we're really coming to grips with understanding the underlying basis for aging and that eventually leads to death. Mm. And this has also led to trying to see if we can do something about it. And the tools of biology are becoming more and more powerful. And as you just said, there's a huge amount of money invested in it. So I felt we're on the threshold of possibly making some serious advances in at least in living more healthily as we age and possibly going beyond that.
Okay. These might sound like silly questions, but I'm going to go with them anyway. I read your book from cover to cover and all the science is there and I suppose the philosophy is there as well, the ethics involved. But let's just get a few sort of straightforward questions out of the way. Is dying inevitable?
Well, I think eventually, I don't think there's such a thing as true immortality. Mm. But whether we can extend our lifespan beyond what is currently our natural limit of about 120, there's no physical or biological law that says we can't, because there are species that live several hundred years. But of course, just the fact that it's theoretically possible doesn't mean it's going to happen tomorrow. I think it's extremely difficult, but it's theoretically possible, I would say.
Mm. And is aging ranked as a disease?
That is also a big hot topic. The WHO and the FDA in the United States do not classify aging as a disease, partly on the grounds that it's inevitable and happens to everybody. So it's not something abnormal like a disease, for example, like cancer or something. But on the other hand, many people feel that most of the diseases that we get when we're older, including diabetes, dementia, heart disease, cancer, all of those, one of the biggest risk factors is age. So the chances of getting those diseases goes up with age. So these people would like to say that aging is actually the underlying disease that manifests itself in these various symptoms.
Right.
My opinion is aging is not really a disease, but it can lead to disease.
Okay. So if it was to be classified as a disease, how would it change things for people doing research in the area?
Well, if you want to do clinical trials, one of the first things is, what is the disease you're trying to treat with your clinical trials? Mm. So if aging were classified as a disease, then they could get, for example, FDA approvals for testing out various treatments. Mm. If it's not a disease, then they have to go for some other disease that's a proxy for aging, for example, osteoarthritis or dementia, things like that.
Okay, we'll come back to research later on. So the key elements then of aging and dying, and you in the book, it's so forensic, you do it from a molecular biological point of view, right from the tiniest little part of our bodies, the cellular degeneration, and how that affects everything. But it's very complex, Venky, isn't it? And oftentimes in the book you say we don't quite understand how that works. We don't quite understand how that works. So there's a lot of areas of there's gaps in the knowledge.
Oh, there's huge gaps, but that's true of almost any branch of science. If you go deeply into it, you eventually hit the frontier.
Yeah.
And at the frontiers of science, things are always a little uncertain and fuzzy. So I wouldn't say aging research is that different, but aging is highly complex. That's what makes it difficult. It has multiple causes at all levels, from molecules to cells to the way cells communicate with each other to tissues, etc. And all these multiple levels interact with each other. So it's not as if something that happens to our DNA doesn't affect higher levels. It does, you know, but it's not even just that it goes upward. It can also go downward. So I think people have to understand that it's a complex set of interrelated causes that result in aging and eventually
death. So I suppose that begs the question then, do people die of old age? Or is there always one of those other diseases that you mentioned? Is that usually on the death cert?
You know, a death certificate will never say they died of old age.
Right, okay.
They usually say they died of heart failure or something. So I think what happens is you can think of aging as an accumulated set of damage to our cells.
Wear and tear, sort of.
Wear and tear. Yeah. You know, you can think of it that way, except, you know, we're constantly repairing the wear and tear. So it's when it reaches a critical point where critical things fail. For example, our heart stops beating or brain stops functioning. Then we no longer can work as a complete unit, as an individual. Now, remember, when we die, most of our cells are still alive. Our entire organs are still alive because you can donate them when you die to as a transplant to some recipient. So what do we mean when we say we die? Well, we die because we are no longer conscious. We don't function as an individual. And that's the key. I mean, even if we're not conscious, we could be in a coma and not be dead, you know, but it's when we can no longer function in an irreversible way as an individual. That's what we mean by death.
Yeah, and in the research, you said that we can sort of replenish our cells, and one of the theories is that every 7 years we're completely new individuals, and there's arguments around that. But if we can find ways of artificially replenishing the cells, when that will increase our longevity. What have been the big breakthroughs in this area over the years, Venky?
You mean in terms of replenishing?
No, in terms of research. In terms of overall research.
Well, there are many, many areas. I'll give you a few examples.
Yes.
One of the big areas of research is pathways in our metabolism that are affected by caloric restriction. This is restricting the number of calories we eat.
So fasting or dieting?
Essentially like fasting, but eating very, very moderately.
Right.
So they've done studies in animals where they give them just enough calories so they can survive without being malnourished. So they don't lose weight, they can maintain their weight, but they don't get any more than absolutely necessary. And if you treat animals that way, they seem to be healthier and live longer than animals that are allowed to eat as much as they want. And this has been true in mice and flies and worms and so on. The critics would say that all it shows is that an all-you-can-eat diet is bad for you, because it would be like comparing somebody who's very abstemious with someone who's gorging on an all-you-can-eat buffet every day. And so maybe it's not
common
quite
sense
a fair
would tell
comparison.
Us that that's probably not good, and it's probably going to
decrease
the number
no
of years
what,
on the earth. Yeah,
sure. But no matter what, it means that eating moderately or eating reduced calories is helpful. Mm. So biologists are trying to understand why is it helpful, and They're looking at the pathways that are affected by caloric restriction. And then they're asking, can we inhibit these pathways by medicines, by drugs, which would somehow mimic the effect of caloric restriction and perhaps be even stronger? Now, you might say, well, why not restrict calories? Well, first of all, restricting calories is quite hard, as anyone knows who's tried to fast. But the other is that, for example, eating moderately and exercising and all of those things are also useful for reducing your cholesterol or not getting diabetes or lowering your blood pressure. And yet, despite the fact that I've done all those things, I still had to eventually go on medication for my blood pressure and my cholesterol. So I think natural interventions are extremely good and should always be the first port of call. But sometimes you might have to go beyond that. So if we're trying to keep people healthy in the 80s and 90s, maybe you need additional interventions.
Right. And you talk about metformin in the book, if people want to read it. Now, I mentioned the billions that have been invested in this research. Who's coming up with the money?
Well, a lot of it is coming from governments because we're all facing an aging society. You know, all of us, Ireland, the UK, the US, all of us are facing aging societies. Japan is something of a vanguard. It has one of the most aging societies of all. And so there's an imperative to try to see if older people, as they age, remain healthy, remain independent, and possibly also remain productive. And so there's a lot of effort to ensure healthy aging. Mm. But of course, there's also a lot of money coming from private capital. And noteworthy among those is money from tech billionaires in California. Now, these are mostly middle-aged men. And although they profess to have altruistic motives, I wonder whether they simply like their lives so much that they don't really want to age. And you'll find many of these longevity advocates and life extension advocates also from that community.
Yeah, I'm just looking. You mentioned Brian Johnson in the book, and he has had 33,000 images of his bowel in his lifetime. I think he's only
He's a strong believer in gathering as much data as possible. He spends millions every year on collecting all sorts of data, blood samples,
on himself,
this, that, and
on
the
himself,
other.
Yeah,
on himself, and he thinks of himself as some sort of longevity pioneer that he will try all these things and make his data available to researchers. So he sees himself, I think, in that spirit. And one of the things he tried, to back up, when an older animal was connected to a younger animal, so they shared their blood system, it turned out that the young blood from the younger animal benefited the older animal. Mm. And so before anything was done on humans, all these companies sprang up, mostly in the U.S., I should say, which would get young blood from donors people they paid for, presumably, and then they would sell the blood plasma to rich people who wanted these transfusions of young blood. Mm. And Brian Johnson, in the spirit of being a pioneer, actually roped in his family and he roped in his son and his father, and they all sort of engaged in blood transfusion, going from the younger to the older to the oldest. But I believe that after some time, he didn't see any benefits, and so he stopped doing that.
Yeah, I was on his X account, his Twitter account. He's in the Bahamas. He says, this is my second time in 5 months needing to travel outside the US to receive a safe therapy in a clinical trial on the frontiers of regenerative medicine. The US would be wise to invite innovation in. So he's getting bone marrow mesenchymal stem cells. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So stem cells.
Go on.
Yeah, this is again highly premature. And it's okay if he wants to take that risk. That's his business. But this is the idea that as we get older, we lose stem cells, which are the cells involved in regenerating tissue, including our blood cells, our skin, all of the various types of cells are regenerated by stem cells, which are specialized for that. And as we get older, we're depleted of stem cells. We have fewer stem cells, and they're of poorer quality. Mm. And so scientists are now trying to see if they can program cells to go backwards in development so that they can become stem cells again and help with regeneration. And that's been there's been some exciting results in mice. But of course, this kind of thing poses all kinds of risk, including risk of cancer. So it requires very careful animal trials first, long-term studies, and then in animals that are closer to us, and then human trials before it's at all ready for prime time. But there are always people who will jump the gun.
Could he happen upon something? And I know it's maybe outside of the usual rules that apply to scientific research.
No, I think what these people do is they take some very preliminary findings and they're very eager to try it and they sort of jump the gun. But there's, in all of these things, there's a process to ensure both efficacy and safety. Mm. And these people are simply not following that. Maybe they're impatient.
Okay.
You know? But that carries its own risks.
So there's Aubrey de Grey and Stephen Ostad. So Aubrey de Grey reckons that the first person to live to 1,000 has been born already. Stephen Ostad's a little bit more conservative. He says, I think the first person who will live to 150 is already alive. Yeah. You've mentioned 120, and that's Jeanne Clement, is it, that lady? She was 122.
Sean Calmon.
Yeah, Sean Calmon,
a French woman.
Yes, yeah. So she was 122. Yeah. So is there a figure at the moment that we think is the cutoff point? Well, I suppose 122,
is it? So 122 is the longest life for which we have accurate records. And but what's interesting is in the 30 years since she died, no one else has cracked even 120.
Right.
And even though we're having more and more centenarians in developed societies as medicine has advanced, more people are reaching their 80s and 90s. So enough of them are surviving past 100. So the number of centenarians is growing, but the number of people over 110 is actually not growing. And certainly no one has surpassed 120. And so this suggests that around 120 is probably the natural limit of our biology. And this is, unless, of course, we figure out ways to intervene in our natural biology. And so what Ostad is betting on is that aging research will result in breakthroughs that will get us beyond 120, up to 150, before 150 years have passed, so somebody who's already born can benefit from those discoveries. Mm. What Aubrey de Grey is betting on is that as we get older, aging research will buy us another 50 years, but in those 50 years, we'll have bought another 50 years.
I see. Yes.
And so we'll keep on extending.
Yes.
And he calls this longevity escape velocity.
Right. Okay.
I should say his views are at one extreme end of the spectrum of beliefs among scientists.
Yeah, 1,000. I don't know. How are you on it? I know.
I certainly don't subscribe to de Grey's.
I'm wondering, given the choice, would you like to live to 1,000?
I think it might get very boring. I think a lot of our lives are interesting partly because we know we have a certain amount of time.
Yeah,
and that drives us to make the most of it. So, you know, the saying goes, live a full life rather than a long life. And I think that's a good philosophy. And it also means, you know, you can't, if you have a society where nobody dies for hundreds of years, then you're going to have something of a stagnant society. Now, people say that, well, at different phases in that long lifetime, they will have different careers and different things. But, you know, we're already living twice as long as people 100, 150 years ago. Are we really doing so many more different things in our lifetime as our, you know, Mozart or Beethoven or...
And you, which is a bit depressing, I have to say, because I'm, you know, nearly 60. And you say that if you look at people in history, in science and the arts, that they achieved their greatest work in their 20s, 30s and 40s at a push.
Yeah. It is true. And I think part of it, it's not... My feeling, and I've... one person I discussed this with is the novelist Kazuo Ishiguro, who pointed out that even writers, you know, you would expect writers to gain in wisdom and insight as they get older and write even greater novels. But if you look at writers retroactively and ask what was their greatest work, you know, people like Tolstoy wrote War and Peace before he was 40. So I do feel that sometimes creativity and real insight come from being open-minded, and we're most open-minded when things are fresh, when they hit us for the first time, and that's usually when we're young. And so I do think when we're older, we may continue to do good stuff, but it'll be sort of more of the same. It's very rare that somebody does something dramatically different.
More of the same. I suppose if the first stuff we do is good enough, more of the same is fine.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are scientists, you know, who are in their 60s and 70s who are publishing really good papers, although some of it is because they have bright young people around them who are doing all the work and a lot of the thinking as well.
You say in the book that you've looked out on the gene pool in that your dad is 97. So is longevity hereditary?
There's certainly a hereditary component to longevity. How much your genes contribute and how much it's environmental is a matter of debate. A study on twins said only 25% was heritable, that is, you could be attributed to genetic causes. But it is also true when you look at centenarians, one of the things they seem to have is they seem to have long-lived parents or relatives. So many of them. I think it's a mixture, but there's definitely a genetic component.
Okay, you say that the research mainly done on mice, worms, fireflies. There's a new study in the States on domestic dogs, which is a breakthrough in that they're bigger.
It's not just that they're bigger; it's they're not kept in sterile cages.
They're open to disease and all that sort of thing.
They're in a natural environment. Exactly the sort of environment their owners would be in.
Okay.
And so in that sense, it's a better test. But I heard that study had some issues with funding, so I don't know what the current now, status of that study is.
Anti-aging medication. Talk us through that. Is there such a thing, or is that an oxymoron?
Well, there are people, for example... there's a drug called rapamycin, which affects a pathway that is also affected by caloric restriction. And when they give rapamycin, now the thing about rapamycin is it was discovered originally as an antifungal compound. Then they found it was also effective against tumors. Then they found it was an immunosuppressant. So it's got a variety of properties. And that's because it affects a pathway that has so many different effects. But it's an immunosuppressant. It's given to organ transplant recipients, for example, to suppress rejection of the graft. So this compound in mice has shown to have beneficial effects. It has extended lifespan. It has improved many of the markers of aging. So a number of aging researchers are advocates of trying to see if rapamycin can be used to age more healthily. Now, of course, rapamycin, because it's an immunosuppressant, has side effects. It makes you more prone to infection. You heal wounds less. It has a number of other effects as well. So the question is, can you find a sweet spot where you don't have the detrimental side effects, but still get the benefits of the anti-aging effects? And how would it work in humans? lots of things work in mice that don't necessarily translate well into humans because we have a much longer lifespan and our metabolism is somewhat different. So I would say it's one of those things which is serious science, but really needs to be carefully studied.
And you suggest that some of the scientists who are working in this area are self-medicating with rapamycin behind closed doors.
That is what I was told by a scientist who actually studies rapamycin. He wasn't talking about himself, I don't
okay.
think.
Now,
but anyway.
But it leads us on to serious enough questions. How long is it since Dolly was cloned in Scotland?
I forget. Maybe 30 years.
Yes.
I don't remember
okay.
the date. Yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So always there's, you know, rumors afoot that somebody in a laboratory somewhere is cloning humans or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, would you be happy that you know what's going on? Or do you think that there's a lot of scientific work going on outside of the normal respected scientific circles?
I think there's very little science. Well, there's science going on in private companies that they keep secret for proprietary reasons. Mm. So that, of course, we don't know. But even those companies present work at conferences because the way they continue to get funded and invested is by telling people what they've done. So I would doubt very much that there's a lot of funny business going on,
okay.
You know, in some secret lab. There may be some weird, you know, as you mentioned, this guy went to the Bahamas or something. There may be some a few labs like that. But I don't think those are the people who will be driving major research. Major research requires top-level scientific infrastructure and
but
high-level
scientists.
But
you do say that a lot of the top scientists are you know, going after the dollar. And then you say...
They are. I mean, many of them... I wouldn't say they're motivated strictly by monetary concerns. I think, you know, many of them have gone, for example... to Altos Labs, which was funded by a bunch of tech billionaires. These are top scientists. Now, they're not influenced purely by money. That I'm sure that's a factor.
Mm.
But they're also influenced by the resources they can have to accelerate their work.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't.
You do say in the book, which I love this quote, it's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding.
Yes, that's a famous quote by Upton Sinclair,
yeah.
A famous writer. So,
there you go.
I think it's not just scientists.
So for our listeners,
it's the investors as well.
Yes, because they want results, of course. And they, you know, we've all seen Bad Blood. The story of Elizabeth Holmes. What a brilliant story. So, Venky, before we leave you then, what can we do? This is going to really annoy people because...
I know what you want.
In
my book.
I know, it's going to annoy people. Go on, to improve our longevity.
In my book, I focused on three things that affect our biological pathways, which are exercise, a moderate and healthy diet, and sleep. Sleep is often underappreciated.
Yeah.
Now, those are three important things for our biology. I didn't talk about some of the social things because they don't really directly impinge, but things like, so you know, not being lonely, socializing.
Connected.
And reducing stress.
Yeah.
All of those things help.
Yeah.
They currently help better than any anti-aging medicine on the market.
Yeah, so you can forget your cryogenics, your ribosomes, your mitochondria, your Yamanaka factors and all that.
Well, no, they affect the mitochondria.
I know, but they affect it. But it's the three things there. Very simple, and it would have been a very short book, though. Venky Ramakrishnan.
Well, the hope is to go beyond that.
Thank you again for writing the book. It's a fascinating read. Why We Die, The New Science of Aging and the Quest for Immortality. Thanks, Venky. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.